This is Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. On today's show, we'll talk with filmmaker and journalist Jason Berry. His film, City of a Million Dreams, screens in New Orleans tomorrow night, shedding light on the city's history through the unusual lens of the jazz funeral. But first, we catch up with actor Brian Batt. Dear Mr. Williams, a coming-of-age, one-man play set in New Orleans is back at Le Petit Theater, this time as a full production. The work by veteran Broadway actor, author, and native son, Brian Batt, is his life's journey through his formative years, told with inspiring words from the celebrated works of Tennessee Williams. Brian Batt joins us by phone. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Diane. I'm so glad to be here.
This must be quite exciting for you, as your solo show is the first live performance at Le Petit since the beginning of the pandemic. How does it feel to be back?
It feels great. It's like going home. You know, it's the 105th season of Le Petit Theater in the gorgeous French Quarter. And, you know, yeah, post-pandemic, post-it, it's kind of hard for the arts. So I'm just, you know, encouraging people to come out and come see the show this last weekend at Le Petit Theater. It's a love letter to New Orleans with my words and the incredible words of probably the best American playwright, Tennessee Williams.
Now, this play was first seen as an informal reading produced by Le Petit Theater during the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival back in 2018. Tell us, how did the idea come about, and how did you move the project forward?
Be careful what you wish for. I was, you know, worked with and did things for the Tennessee Williams Festival, and they do these tribute readings. And one year after the reading, I said, you know, next year is the tricentennial, which is something, you know, that celebrates New Orleans with Tennessee's words. And I said, why don't you write it? So I did. We did a reading of it, and some producers happened to be in the audience, and my dear friend Betty Buckley was there. And she's so wonderful and supportive. She came running up going, you must continue with this. And the producers wanted to keep it going, so we did a workshop in New York, we did a workshop in New Orleans, and a reading in St. Louis, and it was scheduled to be on the boards last March of 2020, but you know, something happened.
So we continued
to work on it, and then Le Petit said, why don't we just open the season with this? It's perfect for New Orleans. It's a one-man show, so it's very safe backstage COVID-wise, and we're following all COVID protocol, you know, masks and backs and all that stuff. I will say this, it is exhausting because it's just me on the stage for 95 minutes.
Wow. What compelled you to tell your story with help from the works of Tennessee Williams? Why Tennessee?
First of all, New Orleans is his spiritual home. He loved New Orleans. One of my favorite quotes of his is, my greatest instinct is to be free, and I found that in New Orleans. I love Tennessee Williams, and I remember early on when I started to write this, I remember my first introduction to Tennessee Williams was in school, and it was a Glass Menagerie, and the players at my school put on Glass Menagerie. I remember being changed by it. It really inspired me. And through the years, I would see different works by Tennessee Williams, and they would kind of guide me in a loose way. Most of it's true. I took some poetic license, but, you know, why let the truth get in the way of a good story?
So what is the story that you tell?
I believe everyone has a story. It's just how you tell it. You know, I came from a very interesting family. My grandfather started an amusement park, so I kind of grew up with an amusement park in the backyard. That's kind of crazy. I have friends all over the city. You know, one thing my play does go into is that even though New Orleans loves New Orleans, we have neighborhood snobbery. And, you know, as I say, uptown looks down on downtown, East Bank looks down on West Bank, and the French Quarter looks down on everybody else because, well, it's sort of above sea level. You know, it's my journey of figuring out how to be an actor and go to New York and be true to myself, my true self. Tennessee actually had to leave St. Louis and come to New Orleans to find himself and his mission, and I had to leave and go to New York to find myself and do what I wanted to do. But the good thing is, you know, I think Thomas Wolfe was wrong. You can go home again if your home is New Orleans.
I agree. Can you share some elements of your story from the play?
Well, you know, one thing I love about it, it runs the gamut. And, you know, we did a workshop in New York, and one of the biggest producers on Broadway came to see it. She's friends with my director. She saw the reading, and she said, you know what, I think Brian can go a little further, go a little deeper. And, you know, we're always scared to go to some of those unpleasant places, but we realize that everybody's been there. And when you're faced with adversity, it depends on how you handle it is what determines your character. And there are moments in the play where it can go a certain way, but luckily I was guided by my wonderful parents and sometimes by Tennessee. It's a very interesting journey. What I love is that people are getting it and loving it. Even when we did the reading in St. Louis, people really identified with it. Anybody who ever felt, you know, like they don't fit or they don't belong, it's a journey of triumph and of finding out your true self and being true to yourself. And I think if we could figure out how to do that in this life, that's most of the battle.
Yeah. Can you tell us a story, a short story?
I was introduced to Tennessee Williams, and then right after that, you know, the theatricality of Tennessee Williams and being my first Tennessee Williams play. And then I was Paige in a Mardi Gras parade and ball. And I think from then on, there was a confusion between Mardi Gras and theater and Mardi Gras. There's one part in the play where I literally come out, you know, dressed as a, pretty much as a page on a float with a plume hat. And it's pretty ridiculous. It's really funny. There's also a moment that is very personal, and I think people have to see the play to get it. But it's, you know, a very uncomfortable situation, and there's some sexual overtones. Nothing too graphic, of course. It's, you know, I say it's PG-16. One of my favorite stories is Le Petit, when I was doing a play there, was honoring Helen Hayes, the wonderful actress, first lady of the American stage. And when my parents met her after the show at the post-show gala, she, you know, said, was that your son you related to the young man who played Judas? It was Godspell. And my mom said, oh, yes. She was all encouraging. My father did not want me to be an actor and basically said, well, that's all well and good, but we're discouraging him for being an actor. He wants to do something sensible. And Helen Hayes said, oh, on the contrary, sir, you should encourage him. He's good. And before my dad could protest, she invited them to brunch the next day. So at Commander's Palace over turtle soup and banana foster, Helen Hayes negotiated for me and with my father. And if I would complete my education, Dad would allow me to go to New York and help me move up there. So we have Helen Hayes to thank. Yeah, so that was one of my favorite stories. And what was great was my director, Michael Wilson, just wanted to find everything out. He wanted every little story I could possibly tell. And some stayed, some went by the wayside. And what's left, I think, is really the heart, you know, and soul, and tells the story as best it can be told. With humor and with laughter and smiles and a few tears, maybe. But like I always said, without the hurt, the heart is hollow.
Yeah. You had some challenges?
Oh, yes. Don't we all?
Yeah.
Yep. You have to go to the bottom of the mountain to reach the, to know what the top is. You know?
Do audiences get to know the real Brian Batt, not the actor in the show?
Yes, they do. There are things that I've never really talked about that are discussed in this play, and a lot of people, I think, will be able to identify with it.
Actor and author Brian Batt, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, and come on down to Le Petit Theater and support the arts.
Performances of Brian Batt's Dear Mr. Williams, directed by Michael Wilson, are running through October 24th. More info is online at lepetittheater.com.
Whether we know it or not, we have all been touched by Tennessee Williams. Wait. That did not come out right. Like Tennessee, New Orleans is my spiritual home.
America has only three cities: New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. Everywhere else is Cleveland.
But I do know for certain that his work, his words, and his life have touched me profoundly. And in a way, saved me.
There comes a time in your life when you look into the mirror and you realize that what you see is all you'll ever be. And you accept it, or you kill yourself. Or you stop looking in mirrors.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. A documentary by author, journalist, filmmaker and native son, Jason Berry, will make its Louisiana premiere this week in advance of November's 32nd Annual New Orleans Film Festival. City of a Million Dreams tells the history of the Crescent City through an unusual lens, shedding light on the customs of New Orleans jazz funerals. Jason joins us by phone. Jason, congratulations.
Thank you, Diane. It has been a long road, that's for sure.
I know this was a labor of love for you. That was a long time in the making. The film shares the same title as your book, which was released in the city's tricentennial year, 2018. How did the film come to be?
Well, the film and the book sort of matured and overlapped over quite a span of time. I got very curious about jazz funerals in the late 90s. I had been to quite a number of them as a journalist writing about music, but it was a conversation with Dr. Michael White, clarinetist, that clued me into the fact that with the crack epidemic hitting New Orleans so terribly, a good many young second-liners and people, you know, in the community were dying. And the funerals for these kids, some of them, you know, too young to vote, were quite different from the traditional time-honored funerals with the stately procession of the musicians and then the up-tempo, high-kicking music of the second line afterwards. He complained, and so did Greg Stafford, the trumpeter, Milton Batiste, who was with Olympia. They complained of the spirituality and tradition being stripped out of these funerals and that it was only the second line portion of it, and a lot of that was pretty raucous. So I got interested in the whole conflict of continuity and change. I got money from the Ford Foundation, and I filmed a good many interviews and funerals, and that's kind of how it got going in the late 90s. By the time I had the film the way I thought it should be shot and edited, Katrina hit, and of course everything was upended at that point.
What inspired the title of the book and the film?
Oh, I stole the title from a wonderful song, City of a Million Dreams, by a late Irish Channel clarinetist, Raymond Burke, who was a friend of Michael White. And in his final years, Mr. Burke would often get a ride home with Michael. And he kind of regaled me about some of the conversations they had. And, you know, I thought about that title, City of a Million Dreams, and it kind of summed up what New Orleans is about. Historically, we are a crossroads of humanity, people from so many diverse backgrounds, not just from Africa and France and Spain, as, you know, we're often taught in the history books, but people from Latin America, certainly since the 1970s, from Vietnam and Cambodia. A good many Mexicans came in after Katrina to help with the rebuilding. So I thought that funerals really afforded a rare lens, a way of looking at the city over time. And so as I worked on the book research and would periodically go out and film another funeral, I began to wonder how they began. And in order to answer that question, I had to go all the way back to the founding of the city and figure out what funerals were like before the dawn of jazz, circa 1900. And I realized that the ring dances at Congo Square, the enslaved Africans performing these burial choreographies in circular formations, appealing to the ancestors, was an African way of honoring the dead, while the European tradition of brass bands was linear, the bands marching through the street. And so the story of the book and the film, as I gradually conceived it, was the coming together of the ring and the line of the African European traditions. And I think in a sense, it tells a larger story of the city.
So let's talk more about what some might call a spectacle or a parade at what is usually a sad occasion. How do you describe this cultural tradition known as a jazz funeral to people who are not from New Orleans?
Funerals are rituals of mourning. The loss of a loved one or an important person, as the case may be, in the community, whoever it might be. We grieve over that person leaving. And yet at the same time, the music of the songs of religious mourning and religious witness become almost like the course of a Greek tragedy, a way of telling the community that there is loss, that someone has left, that the cosmic order we know is now changing. Whereas after the coffin goes down in the cemetery and the band leaves the graveyard and they break into the up-tempo music, the second-line music, and all kinds of spontaneous choreographies of the streets then begin to play out in front of our eyes, what we're witnessing is, you know, what the musicians call the cutting loose of the soul from earthly ties. So it is a drama that begins, you know, with the colors of tragedy and loss, and then ends with a celebration of ascent and resurrection.
A true celebration of life.
Celebration of life, indeed. Funerals are about the living. We remember the dead, but we gather to console ourselves.
So who are some of the principals in the film, and how does this story unfold?
The two protagonists, the two navigational figures of the film, are Dr. Michael White, the clarinetist, and Professor Xavier, who has played in a great many funerals over the last 40 years. I think he estimates something like 200 of them. Greg Stafford, his trumpet-playing sidekick, is part of Michael's story. And the other person is Deb Big Red Cotton, as she was known, a popular blogger for Gambit, who posted a great many videos and covered the second line, the social aid and pleasure clubs, you know, in much the way that other journalists cover City Hall or the New Orleans Saints. It was her beat, and she mastered it like a historian. So through Deb, we meet people like Fred Johnson, the leader of Black Men of Labor, and other members of his organization. We filmed their annual parade. And the story, the visual narrative, moves back and forth between Michael, who is on a journey into the past, searching for information about his ancestor, Papa John Joseph, who played at Preservation Hall in the very first generation, way back in the mid-60s. And as Michael is tracing the lineage of Papa John all the way back to the turn of the century upriver in St. James Parish, Deb is, you know, forging ahead with her writing and film work about the clubs today. And when Hurricane Katrina hits, the story takes a pretty dramatic turn, plunging both of them into a search for the soul of the city.
What does this exploration of jazz funerals reveal about the resilience of the city and of Black culture?
We filmed quite a sustained sequence of the Congo Square dances with a great deal of help from Monique Moss, a diaspora scholar at Tulane, who is also a choreographer, Titos Sompa, who is a Congolese master percussionist, Seguinon Kone of the Ivory Coast, who performs regularly in New Orleans and lives here a good part of the year, and a good many other musicians and local dancers. And I think that dimension of the film visualizes the cultural memory of African-blooded people. You know, funerals are caravans of memory. Over the years, I've attended several hundred funerals, I guess. I've filmed perhaps 25 or 30. But I think each one stands almost as a nonfiction short story about the city at a given point in time. You know, the first funeral with music I was able to document in writing the book was the funeral for Carlos III in 1789. He was the king of Spain, who put a great deal of money into the rebuilding of New Orleans after the terrible fire of 1788. And when he died, it took 4 months before the word by ship got back to, you know, this port at the bottom of North America. And the Cabildo, the governing office, immediately ordered a celebration, a mourning for the king. And in the Cabildo, there's a remarkable account of all of these people marching through the city to a Spanish band performing in the street. They don't give us the names of the songs, but there's quite an elaborate description of the people who were marching, and they referred to them in that document as the illustrious body, capital I, capital B, the illustrious body. Well, this was kind of the first, second line in a very real sense. And so as I gathered, you know, those historical accounts, I was mightily impressed with the way brass bands entered the scene in a major way in the 1850s during the yellow fever epidemics. And we have a sequence on yellow fever in the film. So it was these antecedents that, you know, gave me a vivid and almost visceral sense of what life was like in those decades and generations leading up to the birth of jazz.
What other themes are explored as you delve into this custom of dancing for the dead?
The way in which people express grief, I think, is a kind of varied and ongoing process, a kind of evolution. And so we tried to focus on that as best we could in the various funerals and second lines that we filmed. And the others, Tim Watson, my editor, who is an absolutely brilliant film editor, spent months dealing with the archival footage from the historic New Orleans collection shot by Jules Kahn. Many people remember Jules. He was a presence at funerals for years. In fact, he told me in the summer of 95, I'll never forget, he told me that the funerals in the 1960s were like urban ballets. And years later, when we started looking at all that footage, Tim and my other co-producer, Simonette Berry, my daughter, and I, we spent months going through those various scenes, which Tim ultimately edited. And it was like peering back into the past with a huge telescope, looking from the wide lens down to the thin one, and seeing all these folks dancing in such beautiful ways, prefiguring the way that people dance today in Second Line.
Wow. Filmmaker and author Jason Berry, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Diane, it is always a pleasure, and thank you for thinking of me.
Jason Berry's City of a Million Dreams will screen tomorrow, October 20th, at the Broadside Theater, 7 p.m., and Thursday, October 21st, at the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, Powerhouse Theater. Also, starting November 5th, the film will be shown virtually for a limited time during the New Orleans Film Festival. More info is online at neworleansfilmfestival.org and cityofamilliondreams.com. This week, WWNO New Orleans Public Radio and WRKF Baton Rouge Public Radio continue our fall membership drives, a time to remind you that great shows like Louisiana Considered are funded primarily by you, our listeners. Because we are a public service, we report on and to the public, not to corporations or shareholders. This means you can trust what you hear on WWNO and WRKF, and you can always turn to public radio when you need accurate, unbiased information, especially during such challenging times when you need to know the facts to make decisions that impact your life. But this public service requires public participation. Support shows like Louisiana Considered, and more by becoming a member during our fall drives. Online at wwno.org/donate or wrkf.org. And thank you. This has been Louisiana Considered for a Tuesday afternoon, coming to you from WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I want to thank all of our guests on today's show, veteran Broadway actor Brian Batt, and filmmaker and journalist Jason Berry. You can always listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday here on WWNO and WRKF. Visit us online to find out more about today's episode or any other episodes. You can always stream us or download the podcast by going to your favorite podcast platform. Thanks to today's technical producers, Patrick Madden, Thomas Walsh, Aubrey Purcell, and Garrett Pittman. Thank you for listening. I'm Diane Mack.